Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Superpowered's Year One by Drew Hayes. Narrated by Kyle McCarley. Prologue. The two well-dressed men materialized outside of a small, white brick building. The taller of the two pulled out a miniature notepad, made an entry with the slash of a few pen strokes, and then stowed it away once more.
"Where are we, Mr. Transport?"
The speaker was the shorter man, wearing a black suit with a black tie, and presently putting on a pair of black sunglasses to fight back the sun's penetrating glare.
"Arizona, Mr. Numbers," replied the taller man, who, by elimination, could only be Mr. Transport, as he adjusted the sunglasses he had put on before they departed.
"I was under the impression our next case was in Colorado," commented Mr. Numbers.
"He was. However, there was an incident last week. Circumstances required that he be moved to a location able to accommodate his specific needs."
"I see," said Mr. Numbers.
With that, the two of them walked around to the front of the building and proceeded inward. They were stopped as soon as they entered, not by the expected poorly paid security guard, but rather by an elderly man wearing a white lab coat.
"Good morning, gentlemen. I've been expecting you," said the white-coated man. "My name is Dr. Hubert."
Mr. Numbers cocked his eyebrow slightly, and Mr. Transport replied with an almost imperceptible nod. This exchange took the place of the relevant conversation, which would consist of Mr. Numbers asking if the name and call-ahead had checked out, and Mr. Transport reporting that it had. This method was more efficient, though, and had the added benefit of allowing the duo to take people by surprise when things were not quite so congruent.
"We'd like to see the boy," said Mr. Numbers.
"Of course you would," Dr. Hubert agreed. "However, first, I'm afraid I must ask you to take off anything electrical. Watches, phones, anything with a battery must go. I do hope neither of you has a pacemaker."
Neither Mr. Numbers nor Mr. Transport had pacemakers. They did both carry expensive, high-powered phones, though, as well as top-of-the-line watches and a pair of taser guns. All of these were deposited into a small safe in the front lobby area with Dr. Hubert's adamant assurances that everything would be returned once they were done. Neither Mr. Numbers nor Mr. Transport showed any concern about the safety of their valuables. Once that was completed, Dr. Hubert pulled out a small candle and lit it, then repeated the procedure twice more until all three men were equipped with a diminutive wax lighting instrument. Dr. Hubert kept expecting one of the men to ask why they had shed their electronics and were being handed candles in the middle of the day. They did not. Dr. Hubert led them through the doors of the lobby into a dimly lit hallway covered in green tile. They made their way down it, coming to a solid steel door at the end. Dr. Hubert made a quick series of punches on the keypad, and the door released, opening to reveal total darkness. As the trio stepped through, the door shut behind them, leaving them with only their candles to see by. Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport paused to remove their sunglasses. Their eyes adjusted, and they realized they had stepped into another hallway, this one formed of solid concrete. There were no doors to their sides, only another metal one at the end of the hallway. Dr. Hubert began the walk down, moving more briskly than he had before. Mr. Numbers observed that the deeper into this place they went, the more nervous Dr. Hubert became. He filed that away, and then began following, a few paces behind. They made their way down the hallway without incident, then stepped through the next metal door. Inside was what looked like a large, concrete bunker, with a sizable glass window peering into the next room. Though both strained, they could not make out anything in the pitch black on the other side of the glass.
"He's normally more stable than this," Dr. Hubert said. "But unfortunately, he was trying to fix his toaster a few days ago and received a nasty electrical shock."
"Ah," said Mr. Numbers. "So that's why a quarter of Colorado lost power last week."
"Yes,"
admitted Dr. Hubert.
"Before he was able to sever the connection, he had drained his own city's power supply, along with that of all the areas surrounding it. We're trying to help him burn off all that electricity, but it comes in spurts and is almost impossible to predict."
"I see," said Mr. Transport.
"It's also affecting his natural abilities,"
continued Dr. Hubert.
"That's why I had you remove all electrical devices, and why we are keeping him out of the sunlight. He's been pulling from anything that gets even remotely close to him."
As if on cue, Mr. Numbers' candle jerked violently in the direction of the window and went dark.
"I'm sorry he's not more stable today,"
Dr. Hubert apologized again.
"If he were, he wouldn't be in consideration for our program," said Mr. Numbers, eyes still trained on his now dark candle.
"Oh, does that mean you're still counting him as a possibility?"
Dr. Hubert asked.
"There will be some preliminary testing and an interview process," said Mr. Transport. "But if I were to offer my opinion, I would say we have a very viable candidate on the other side of that glass."
Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport next materialized before a hospital in Nevada. Mr. Transport again produced his notepad, jotted down a few scribbles, and then put it back where it belonged.
"Another incident?" Mr. Numbers asked.
"Par for the course with this one, to my understanding,"
replied Mr. Transport. The duo then entered the hospital. They spoke briefly to a nurse, producing badges that rendered her silent, procured the information they needed, and then headed upstairs. It was something of a walk to get where they were heading, and by the time they were done, they had crossed out of the main hospital and into a more run-down attachment wing. The doctors here were fewer and more haggard, and the walls looked worn down and repainted. Hospitals were never what Mr. Transport thought of as cheerful, but this area was enough to inspire one to end it all, which very well might have been the point. Mr. Numbers stopped at the appropriate room, and the two entered. It was like the rest of the wing, worn down, beat up, and hopeless. This one had two unique additions, though. A young man lying in a hospital bed, and a recently exploded television that was still smoking.
"Mr. Campbell," greeted Mr. Transport. "A pleasure to meet you."
"Call me Nick," said the boy. He spoke with an easy tone that matched his overly relaxed appearance. Despite the mandatory hospital gown, he had still taken the time to gel his thick hair.
"And I take it you two are my interview committee?"
"Indeed," confirmed Mr. Transport.
"What happened to the television?"
"Beats me. I went to turn the thing on, and I guess the tube's overloaded or something," answered Nick.
"I see," said Mr. Transport skeptically.
Mr. Numbers had been browsing through Nick's chart during the exchange with Mr. Transport, and chose this time to jump in.
"So, according to the records, you won a $10,000 scratch-off ticket, after which you were hit by a bus while celebrating in the street, which knocked you into a bounce house that had been set up nearby. A bounce house whose motor had the poor timing to overload and explode after your impact. Do I have everything correct?"
You might want to tack on that my winnings just covered my hospital bill and damages owed to the bounce house owner, Nick added.
You were held accountable for the damages, Mr. Transport said.
It wasn't a question, but Nick chose to take it as one anyway.
Well, you know how it is. People tend to blame my kind first and ask questions later, Nick said, not quite managing to mask the bitterness in his voice.
We know, Mr. Campbell, said Mr. Numbers. That's exactly what brought us here today.
Mr. Transport walked over to the room's entrance and shut the door firmly. The two next appeared in a forest. This wasn't a forest in the sense of parks that can seem sprawling, or a cluster of spruces that can form on the side of an untended highway. This was a forest in an ancient and powerful sense, with trees that were massive and served as ecosystems within their ecosystem. This was a place untouched and unaware of all the progress Homo sapiens had made with their pitiful time upon the Earth. Untouched, that is, with the exception of the trailer a few feet away from Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport. Sitting in a rocking chair, sipping a glass of lemonade, was a young girl whose file said 17, but whose face said 14. She was wiry and lean, with short hair that poked up in several different directions. She stared at the two of them unblinkingly, and the two stared right back at her. The three of them stood in silence for several minutes like that, the girl's eyes flitting between the two of them, theirs remaining constant on her. At last, the girl took a long sip of her lemonade and said out loud,
"That sounds lovely."
A simultaneous nod came from Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport, and then they were gone.
"Herschel, come downstairs. The nice men are here to see you."
The speaker was a dowdy woman in her 50s who was setting down a kettle and cups in front of Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport.
"Are you sure I can't get you gentlemen anything to eat?"
"Thank you, Mrs. Daniels, but we are quite comfortable," said Mr. Numbers.
"Oh, no need for that. Please, call me Sally,"
Mrs. Daniels replied, her eyes lingering on Mr. Numbers and the strong figure housed beneath the covering of his black suit.
"Good morrow, my men,"
said Herschel as he descended the stairs into the yellow-painted kitchen. Herschel was a portly young man with long, dirty blonde hair dribbling down to his chin and a forest-green shirt underneath the rich royal purple of his cape.
"Why are you wearing a cape?"
Mr. Transport was unable to suppress his own curiosity.
"It's a cloak," Herschel corrected. "After we partake in a large lunch, my men and I are taking the castle up at Rothring Peak and doing battle with a foul vampire lord." "My little Herschel is a bit overly creative,"
Mrs. Daniels commented.
"He and his friends are active in the community's live-action role-playing club."
Mr. Numbers and Mr. Transport exchanged a look. There is no need for clarification on the meaning of this one.
"Well, we don't want to keep you,"
Mr. Numbers said honestly.
"However, we were hoping to speak with Roy, if that's at all possible."
"Oh,"
said Herschel, disappointment sweeping across his face.
"Of course, everyone wants to talk to Roy."
"It's just that we have some things to discuss with him,"
Mr. Numbers attempted to clarify.
"I'm sorry," Herschel said. "I don't think he'll be around today. He went to a country bar last night and... well, he usually doesn't show up for a while after uproars like that."
"Aw," said Mr. Transport. "That does explain the cleanup crew that was dispatched this morning."
Mr. Numbers shot Mr. Transport a look, but Mr. Transport merely shrugged, as if to say he didn't find it to be of any importance.
"If that's the case, then we will be on our way," said Mr. Numbers. "I don't want to keep you from your activities. We will need to speak with Roy at a later date."
"Wait,"
Herschel said, jumping to his feet.
"I know what you're here about, and I really want to get in. I'm tired of living like this, never knowing when it will happen, never knowing where I'll wake up. Please, if you can really help me control it, please don't leave."
"It's okay, Herschel," Mr. Transport said, as he patted the large boy on his shoulder. "We aren't giving up on you just because of a reschedule. You're a serious candidate for our program. I promise we'll be back once we can talk to Roy as well."
Herschel nodded his understanding, and then turned away quickly so the two men wouldn't see the tears forming in his eyes. He didn't know what his chances were at the moment, but he was smart enough to guess that crying in front of the agents wouldn't help things. Mr. Numbers tapped impatiently on Mr. Transport's shoulder and gestured to his watch. Mr. Transport nodded, and then turned his head to Mrs. Daniels.
"Thank you for the tea," said Mr. Transport, just before they vanished.
The duo appeared in a sprawling garden, under a gazebo and next to a pair of wicker chairs. There was a small serving cart on the far side of a stone table. Sitting next to the cart, and sipping on a cocktail, was a man. He wore a white, open-throated shirt and a pair of khakis. This man was getting on in years, but wearing them unbelievably well. It's not that the signs of age weren't present, but that they served to draw out and enhance his fine features rather than muddle them.
"I'm glad you could make it,"
greeted the man, in a voice that made clear, without apology, that he had never considered their presence optional.
"Our pleasure, Mr. Adair,"
Mr. Numbers said hurriedly. For the first time all day, for the first time in years, really, the pair was showing signs of nervousness. They had been told of their required presence for this meeting, but not about the subject matter it concerned. That left both of them feeling something they were not accustomed to. Vulnerable.
"Sit, sit," said Mr. Adair. "Can I get you something to drink?"
"I'd like a gin and tonic, if it's no trouble, sir," said Mr. Transport.
This was their final meeting of the day, so Mr. Transport didn't see the harm in indulging just a bit.
"Just water for me, thanks,"
said Mr. Numbers. Mr. Numbers was already writing out the riot act he was going to read Mr. Transport for asking for alcohol while on the job, but facially, he was working hard to keep everything upbeat and positive. Mr. Adair pulled two glasses from the cart at his side, then a carafe from which he poured water into both. He handed the glass as it was to Mr. Numbers, but dipped his finger into Mr. Transport's. Immediately, the liquid bubbled and fizzed, stabilizing seconds later when Mr. Adair handed the glass to Mr. Transport. Both drinks were delicious. Mr. Transport wished his had been made in the traditional way, so he could have asked for a recipe.
"I know you boys are busy, so I won't mince words," said Mr. Adair. "You're here because you two are the admissions committee for the new program that is launching."
"Well, it isn't quite that simple," said Mr. Numbers. "There are evaluations and approvals and whatnot."
"Humility is wasted on the powerful, Mr. Numbers," said Mr. Adair. "You are two of the most trusted agents in your company, and with good reason. You both have abilities that could have made you well-known heroes. Instead, you chose to do the same work without the prestige. You are loyal, reliable, and dependable.
Whomever you recommend for this program will be who gets in. You know it, I know it, and everyone who matters knows it."
Mr. Adair punctuated his words by pouring himself a glass of water and swirling his finger about until the liquid turned a deep golden hue. Mr. Numbers didn't have a reply for this one. He could already see any attempts to defer responsibility on that account were a lost cause.
"So, with that said, I asked you here to meet me because there will be one addition to the program that you will both endorse fully,"
said Mr. Adair, pausing to take a sip of his cocktail.
"And who would that be, sir?"
Mr. Numbers asked.
"My daughter, Alice," said Mr. Adair. "She is a Poward, a person born with superhuman abilities, but unlike a super, she lacks the capacity to freely control them. Though I'm sure your thorough friend here has already found that out."
Mr. Adair gestured to Mr. Transport.
"My research said that she was in the non-lethal category," said Mr. Transport. "She flies, correct?"
"You are correct, Mr. Transport,"
said Mr. Adair.
"My daughter's power is tethered to her emotions, so when she gets happy, she winds up bouncing off the ceiling, if we're lucky enough to have a ceiling over her at the time."
"Forgive me for saying this," said Mr. Numbers, "but the program's initial testing cases are supposed to be powers with desirable abilities that are currently a danger to themselves and others."
"I know," said Mr. Adair. "That's why I called you here to tell you that you would recommend her, instead of going through the channels to submit her as a viable specimen."
"With all due respect, Mr. Adair, that would compromise both our duties to the program and the company," said Mr. Transport.
Mr. Adair said nothing in response at first. He leaned back in his wicker chair and stirred his drink with his finger. As he stirred, the colors changed, going through a rainbow of shades and depths. Finally, it settled on a light pink, and Mr. Adair took a sip.
"Mr. Transport,"
Mr. Adair began,
"you know what my code name is, correct?"
"The Alchemist,"
Mr. Transport answered readily.
"Right. And you know why I am called that, yes?"
"Because you have the ability to manipulate and change the properties of matter," said Mr. Transport.
"Correct again,"
Mr. Adair said.
"So maybe what you are missing is my role in this world. You see, while other supers defend their homes or countries, I defend our economy. I turn radioactive sludge into oil, rocks into gold, worthlessness into pricelessness. Most supers seek to garner favor from politicians and leaders. Leaders and politicians work to garner favor from me. I am one of the primary shareholders of the company you both work for, as well as several other powerful corporations. I am not going to threaten either of you because we all know my abilities are ill-suited to a physical altercation. I am simply going to tell you that you will recommend my daughter for the first trial of the new program. End of story."
Mr. Numbers looked at Mr. Transport. They had been partners for many years and had learned to read each other's cues like a second language. There was no question for Mr. Transport as to what Mr. Numbers was telling him right then. Time to roll over.
"Yes, sir,"
said Mr. Numbers.
"Good. I'm glad we understand each other,"
said Mr. Adair.
"So when will things get started?"
1. 6 months later. Vince adjusted his backpack to put its weight on his other shoulder. 2 months since the procedure had ended, and he'd been put in recovery, and still his body felt like it was aching and healing. He never remembered feeling like this beforehand, but, in all fairness, there were plenty of other things that hadn't existed beforehand either. Today was an excellent example of what going through the program had yielded him. He was walking across the beautiful, sprawling college campus of Lander University, passing other kids his age, and blending in like a normal person. Well, almost, anyway. His damn hair still made him stand out. One of his biggest hopes had been that a side effect of the procedures would be his hair becoming a normal color. But no such luck. It was still silver, like it had always been. And not old man silver, either. Silver like moonbeams glinting off steel. It wasn't that it was unattractive. In fact, it accentuated Vince's bright blue eyes quite nicely. No, the problem was that his hair marked him as different. And after all these years, Vince was yearning to be nothing more than a face in the crowd. "At least we're in California," Vince mumbled under his breath as he quickened his steps. He was getting second glances from the other students, but not as many as he was used to. He also passed a few people whose looks made him do double takes of his own. It was comforting, in a mutual freak sort of way. By the time Vince reached his dorm assignment, he was back on the positive side of things. After all, this was what he had worked for during those 2 months of recovery, studying and being tutored so that he could get his GED and come to this college. It had been hell to concentrate, especially with his body still adjusting to everything, but he had put in the time and pulled it off. It was an opportunity he couldn't let slip away. Besides, the nurses and technicians had told him the other people from the program would be given the option to come here too. The building Vince walked up to looked less like a dorm and more like a medium-sized house. He didn't see how it was possible to fit so many people into this one-story brick home, but he trusted that whoever was managing housing had that in hand. Vince walked through the front door and shifted his backpack once more. It bounced and landed on his shoulder lightly, betraying that it was far from stuffed to the brim with Vince's few articles of clothing and worldly possessions. One of the first things every wanderer lets go of is his unnecessary items. Travel light, move quick, stay alive. That was the code that kept Vince breathing and his abilities in check. But that was behind him. In front of Vince was a cream-colored wall with a notice welcoming him to Melbrook Hall. There was another wall to his left and a hallway to his right. The notice had an arrow directing him to follow the foyer and then take a left. Vince did as he was told and found himself looking at a sturdy door with no window or discernible handle. There was only a small box jutting out with an oval-shaped green pad on top. Vince might not have been the most up-to-date with technology, but even he could figure this one out. He pressed his thumb to the oval, and after a minute, the door opened with a small beep. Vince stepped out of the foyer and into what looked more like a living room than anything else. There were several couches and chairs set up, a metal coffee table in the center of the room, and a large, flat-screen television on the wall directly across from him. Everything was decorated in white and red and smelled like an odd combination of flowers and chemicals, which Vince could only assume meant they were using an artificial air freshener. He walked around the room, taking in the scene. On each wall, perpendicular to the entrance, was another metal door and scanner, a sign above each. The one to the left of the entrance was boys, while the one to the right said, predictably, girls. Vince went over to the television, only to notice that there were open doorways on either side that one could walk through. Vince did just that, and found himself in a white-tiled kitchen. It had a large sink, a stove with multiple burners and a griddle, and all kind of cooking knick-knacks that Vince had neither the knowledge nor the experience to make anything out of. At the back of the kitchen, on the right, was a cupboard, which Vince opened to discover a fully stocked pantry. On the left was another metal door. This one, however, had neither a sign above it nor a fingerprint scanner. Vince walked out of the kitchen and back into the living room, then over to the boys' door. As he walked, he carefully skirted away from wall outlets whenever possible. He hadn't had an accident since the procedure, but that didn't mean he was eager to test his luck. Pressing his thumb to the scanner, the door opened, and Vince walked into what he could only assume was the common room. There was another television on the far end, along with pool and ping-pong tables. The other end held a set of dart boards and a wooden door with the word bathroom on it. Opposite the entrance were three more metal doors. These had scanners clearly in place, but no signs, though they were numbered 1, 2, and 3. With a shrug and a heft of his pack, Vince walked over to the middle door. He pressed his thumb down and waited for the beep, but this time all that came out was a harsh buzzer. He tried twice more before giving up and trying the room on the left, which was room 1. This time, the door buzzed and opened, though Vince couldn't help noticing a chime that followed the usual opening sounds. He wasn't sure what that meant, and the sight before him left him little free brain space in which to contemplate it. Saying his room was luxurious would be something of an overstatement, but it was definitely more opulent than a boy who was always on the run was accustomed to. There was a large bed in one corner, with a desk and computer set up in the other. Between the two was a large window, sunlight streaming through the blue curtains. The floor was carpeted, and as Vince walked across it, he saw that opposite the desk, there was a closet next to a chest of drawers. Slipping his pack off, Vince walked over and pulled open a drawer, trying to figure out if he had enough clothing to warrant any kind of organizational system. He was shocked to see that the drawer he'd opened already contained many, many pairs of socks. Checking the next drawer, he found shorts, then t-shirts. He went back to the top and found boxers. He slammed that drawer shut more quickly than the others. Synapses flying, Vince came to the only logical conclusion. Crud. This is someone else's room. It only made sense. This place was too nice and too well furnished. Why had the door let him in, though? Vince brushed that thought out of his head quickly. It was faulty equipment, not intentional, but it wouldn't make it less awkward if this room's inhabitant came home to find an intruder. Vince turned on his heels, snatching up his backpack and bolting for the door. All of which landed him face to face with a taller boy standing in the doorway, wearing sunglasses and running a comb through his sandy brown hair. 2. Vince froze in place, staring at the room's owner and wondering how to explain the mix-up. It wasn't his fault, after all, but this still wasn't the first impression he'd wanted to make on his new dorm mate. Vince groped around his head, looking for words to break the silence. Luckily, the boy in the door did it for him.
"Dude, that is some rockin' hair," he said.
"Thank you," Vince replied softly. "I'm sorry I'm in your room. The door opened, and I didn't know."
Vince just trailed off, the look of confusion on the boy's face making him more unsure with each passing second.
"You're not in my room, neighbor. You're in your room. I'm in too," the boy told him. "I heard you trying to buzz into mine and realized someone else was here, so I came to say hi."
"But this can't be my room," Vince said, trying to explain. "It already has sheets and clothes and everything."
"Yeah, my guess is that's because they thought you needed those things," the boy with sunglasses explained. "The doors are keyed to us. They only open for the right person. If this room opened for you, then it's because it's your room. Did you even read the letter they gave you?"
"Letter?" Vince asked, with a sense of dread. He did remember a slip of paper that had fallen out of his pack when the taxi had dropped him off, but he had just dismissed it as an old food wrapper or something.
"I'll get mine," said the boy. "Hang on a sec. What's your name?"
"Vince," said Vince.
"Nice. You can call me Nick," he said, as he stepped out of the room.
He came back mere moments later, holding a white piece of paper with fold lines across it.
"Here we go," Nick said. "Rooms have been set up for each attending member by the program. These will be stocked for members as deemed necessary and are keyed to each attendee's individual fingerprints. Communal areas are open to all, but will be under the jurisdiction of your administrators. You are expected to be in the central common room promptly at 7 p.m. on move-in day to meet with your administrators and go over dorm rules."
"Huh," said Vince. "Lucky you held on to that, or I wouldn't have even known about the meeting, let alone about my room." Vince plunked down on his bed, shedding his pack at long last.
"Good choice of words,"
Nick commented, pulling out the chair from Vince's desk and helping himself to a seat.
"What do you mean?" Vince asked.
"It's nothing. Just...
well, you said lucky,"
Nick said.
"And? What about it?"
Vince kept prodding. Instead of answering, Nick pulled a set of dice from his jeans. He closed his eyes, an act only visible despite the sunglasses due to the over-exaggerated scrunching of his face, breathed deeply for a moment, then tossed them onto the desk.
"Double sixes," Vince observed.
Nick nodded. He then took the dice, closed his eyes once more, and, a deep breath later, threw them on the table again.
"Double sixes. Again," Vince said.
"So you use trick dice?"
"Try them," Nick replied.
He scooped up the dice and offered them to Vince. Vince got off the bed, took the dice from Nick's hand, and examined them. They had six different numbers on each side, and felt as though they were weighted normally. Still, Vince wasn't sure enough in his tactile perception to trust merely holding them for an answer. He threw the dice on the desk for himself.
3 and 5, Vince said.
"So you know how to spin them?"
"Do it again," Nick told him.
This time, he closed his eyes and didn't exhale until Vince's throw hit the table.
"Double ones," Vince noted.
"So?"
"Again," Nick instructed him.
Vince repeated his throw 3 more times. Each time, Nick closed his eyes and Vince wound up with double ones. After the 3rd time, Vince let the dice rest on the table. He went back to his bed and sat on the edge.
"Are you telekinetic? Is that how you control the landing?" Vince asked.
Nick shook his head.
"I can't move things with my mind. At least, not on purpose. My power is luck. It can be good, or it can be bad. But if it's luck, I've got some say over it."
"Luck? How does that work? Not to insult, I just tend to think of luck as more of an abstract concept than a viable ability," Vince said.
"No insult taken," Nick assured him. "I don't really know how it works. The docs tried to explain something about quantum probabilities and minute alterations in the fabric of reality,
But at the end of the day, all I know how to say is that it's luck. And mine is a lot better since I got it under control. Vince winced inwardly. That must have been pretty terrible. Before. It was, and it wasn't, Nick said with a shrug. At least my ability came in two flavors. You know, I kissed a supermodel once? She was out with some friends, and they played Spin the Bottle at the restaurant we were both at, and, well, it pointed to me. Of course, then I went outside to find my car had caught fire, but hey, you gotta take the good with the bad. You're upbeat about this, Vince said. Sure am, Nick replied with a smile. That's all in the past. We're not like that anymore. We're the first people in history to go from being powered to being super. I still don't understand what they did to us for those months. And I don't care. Far as I'm concerned, getting into that program was the best stroke of luck my ability ever gave me. So why the sunglasses? Vince said to change the subject. He didn't want to rain on Nick's parade, but he had been dealt too much disappointment in his life to just trust that his abilities were under control now and forever. If anyone in authority asks, it's because using my power can give me headaches that leave me sensitive to light, Nick explained. But between you and me, I just think they make me look cool. What about your hair? Natural? Unfortunately, Vince replied. One of those weird traits people with abilities sometimes get. The damn stuff basically drinks dye, too, so there's no way for me to change its color. You could shave it, Nick pointed out. Thanks, but no thanks, Vince countered. I tried that once. Some guys can pull off the bald look. I am not one of those guys. I'd rather be the weirdo with silver hair than the freakish man-baby. An understandable choice, Nick conceded. Well, with you here, that rounds out the boys' side. I wonder if any girls have gotten here yet. Wait, who's our third roommate? Vince asked. I haven't met anyone but you so far. Our third got here early and went out to explore the campus, Nick told him. You'll see him tonight at the dorm meeting. He's an interesting fella. That doesn't sound good, Vince said. No, but it doesn't sound bad either, Nick pointed out. Come on, you just arrived, and I'm famished. Let's go hit up a dining hall for lunch. Do you know where one is? Vince asked. Not really, Nick admitted, but I bet we get lucky. 3. Alice saw a pair of boys walking away from the building as she was heading toward it. They took no notice of her, clearly absorbed in their own conversation and playing catch with a pair of dice. Her new roommates, no doubt. Fantastic. At least the one with the brown hair was cute, or would be, if he weren't wearing those ridiculous sunglasses in the shade. The other one, though, who was he trying to impress with that hair? Silver and spiky. Was he trying to flunk the secret identity challenge before the semester even started? None of that was her concern, though. Daddy had been strangely unbending in denying her desire to dorm with the regular supers, saying that she had to stay in the dorm set up for the special cases like herself. She didn't really see why she needed to be in the reinforced building. Her ability was only flying, and she had suffered no uncontrolled attacks for over 2 months now. It was insufferable that she would have to, well, suffer through the group accommodations with a bunch of all-too-recently powereds. Alice didn't want to find camaraderie in their shared former disability. She wanted to forget that part of her life had ever existed. Still, no one could say that Alice Adair didn't make the best of a bad situation. She had taken a guiding hand in the construction of their dormitory, creating an environment that was spacious, desirable, and, above all else, elite. She breezed through the hallway, disregarding the note that hung on the entrance. A quick thumb scan took her to the central common room. She surveyed the work of the decorators critically. Yes, it would do nicely. Now, at least, when the other students asked her why she was in this small dorm set off at the edge of campus,
she could humbly explain that it was only available to those of sufficient means to afford such luxury and privacy. It wasn't her ideal situation, but it would work. Alice moved briskly to the girl's side, anxious to get through, lest the last boy be lounging about, hoping to sneak a peek at the other member of the fairer sex that would be sharing his roof space. The girl's side was identical to the boy's, save that there were only two rooms, numbered 4 and 5 respectively. While group bathrooms were fine for males, Alice had been quite insistent with Daddy that she have her own private bathroom. The fact that this meant her fellow female received one as well was a very distant afterthought. On that note, Alice realized her other roommate was sitting in one of the plush pink chairs Alice had picked out, watching the television on mute. It seemed to be a game show, and the girl was as silent as the screen, just watching and occasionally cocking her head to a different angle. The girl was wild, seemed to be the word that popped into Alice's head first. Not wild in the sense of tequila, poor decisions, and eventual therapy, but wild in the way of the jungle. Her hair looked as though no one had even entertained the idea of touching it for years, sticking up at all angles willy-nilly. The girl's clothing was clean at least, though it had the look of something that had been worn for many years. Ironically, Alice's jeans had the same appearance, but hers had achieved the look through corporate innovation and the fashion demands of the public. The most disconcerting thing about the girl, though, was her eyes. While Alice had always considered her own green eyes, especially when paired with her platinum blonde hair, to be rather stunning, they held no candle to the amber irises that encircled this girl's pupils. "Ahem," Alice said, in her best impersonation of a throat clearing. "Good afternoon. I take it that you are my dorm mate?" The girl swiveled her head toward Alice, in a motion that seemed more owl or hawk-like than human. She blinked those round amber eyes twice, then gave an oddly shaped grin. "You snuck up on me," she said. "Oh, well, I do apologize," Alice said formally. Just because the girl seemed uncouth didn't mean Alice could allow her own standards to lapse. "Don't apologize," said the girl. "I just keep forgetting people can do that now. It's a pleasant surprise every time." "All right, then," Alice said, shifting on her feet uncomfortably. She knew everyone staying here had an ability, but she had been unable to wheedle Daddy into telling her precisely what to expect. "My name is Alice. What do you go by?" The girl blinked oddly once more, then cocked her head before answering. "I haven't had any need to go by anything in a long time. My given name is Mary, though it might take a few tries to get my attention with it. As I said, out of practice." "I think Mary is a lovely name," Alice said politely. In truth, she didn't care one way or the other, but since she couldn't very well go around referring to the girl as Freak Eyes all year, at least not out loud, Mary worked fine for her. "I'll do my best to remember it's mine," said the girl who was apparently Mary, turning her head back to the television and watching her show.
If you don't mind me asking, why are you watching that on mute?" Alice inquired. "I used to always watch television like this," Mary replied, without turning around. "I learned to read their lips. That way, if I wanted silence, all I had to do was shut my eyes. It was the only thing in my life where I could actually turn the voices off, so I relished it. I guess old habits die hard." "Ah, well, I see,"
Alice said quickly, eyeing room number 4 and edging her way toward it.
Well, I'll leave you to that, then. See you tonight at the meeting.
With those words, Alice jammed her thumb on her door scanner and popped it open. She slammed the door immediately after and rested against her wall. It was strange how uncomfortable that girl had made her, how it felt like, despite being so disconnected, Mary was looking right through her with those bright amber eyes. Alice had grown up wealthy and aristocratic, and if there was one thing she could not stand, it was the sensation that someone knew what she was really thinking. Outside Alice's door, Mary sat in the chair, eyes still trained on her game show.
"That girl is more perceptive than she thinks,"
Mary whispered to a small stuffed bear that sat between her leg and the armrest of the chair. 4.
"See, I told you we'd get lucky," Nick gloated as he munched on a thick hamburger.
"We didn't get lucky," Vince corrected. "We got lost for half an hour, until I went into a building and asked for directions."
"And wasn't it lucky I brought along a guy with no masculinity issues to ask for directions?"
Nick pointed out. "I think you're stretching on this one," Vince replied, picking at the basket of chicken fingers. Being a wanderer had given him a pretty ironclad stomach when it came to grease and taste, but he'd also always had to subsist on whatever was available at the time. As a result, he had a small appetite and an equally small percentage of body fat. He reflected ruefully that if he just had some muscle on his wiry frame, it would have been very pronounced.
"I might be," Nick admitted. "But then again, you haven't even told me what you can do. Who knows if you're fit to judge the skills of others?"
"Shh!" Vince hushed him quickly. "We're in public. You know we can't talk about that kind of stuff."
"Oh, please," Nick said, taking another bite of his burger and then guzzling down soda. "We're at one of only 5 colleges in the nation that offer certification for supers to become the government-approved responders known as heroes. I'm sure like everyone in this cafeteria is a damn super in disguise."
The young men paused for a moment and looked around. Besides themselves, there was a small group of ladies halfway across the dining hall, and a large table of boys and girls clear on the other end. There were also a few tables where, like Vince and Nick, only 1 or 2 occupants sat. No one in the room looked particularly super, or even interesting for that matter, except for the girl with short, pink and black hair sitting with her friend. Vince did notice her as he did his visual sweep. Even without the colored hair, something about her stood out.
"Okay, maybe half the people," Nick conceded as he finished looking around.
"According to the doctors who told me about this place, less than 0.5% of the student population is enrolled in the Hero Certification Program," Vince informed him. "So odds are pretty good you and I are the only people with abilities here."
Nick let out a low whistle. "Whew. Less than 0.5%? That seems really low."
Vince shrugged. "There are a lot more humans than supers. Even if this is only 1 of 5 schools, Lander is still a big university. A lot of people are going to come here wanting a run-of-the-mill education."
"Poor bastards,"
Nick said, shaking his head. "All kinds of awesome stuff going on around them, and they have no clue about it."
"They better not," Vince said. "I heard that keeping your abilities a secret is like half of your grade. They say if you're found out, you have to do some kind of awful makeup courses to graduate, and that's only an option if you're at the top of the class."
Vince unthinkingly ran his hands through his hair. At least the campus was full of enough people with their own strange features that he might have half a chance of blending in.
"Don't worry about the do," Nick told him. "I didn't think it meant anything significant, and I already knew you had some sort of power when we met. Of course, I still don't know what the damn thing is, but hey, That's what friendships are built around, right? Secrets and mysteries.
You're something of a drama queen, aren't you? Vince asked.
Gasp! A dagger straight into my heart, Nick said, grasping his chest and leaning back in his chair. His breathing became labored, and his hands slumped to the sides.
He was dead. His life ended before its prime by the harsh words of someone he had thought of as a fast-growing friend. But hark! One of his hands lifted, oh so slowly, making its way to the table and grappling the hamburger, before raising it triumphantly to his open and waiting mouth.
"I don't even want to know what's going on in your head right now," Vince said to his slumped-back friend.
"Good call," Nick assured him.
Vince sighed and pushed away his now-forgotten chicken strips. Nick was loud, indiscreet as could be, and showy every chance he got. But he was also the only person to try to be Vince's friend in years, and he knew what it had been like for Vince before. Those two qualities alone made him someone Vince knew he'd need to keep around.
"Get a book of matches and meet me back at the dorm," Vince told Nick.
His words seemed to bring some life back into Nick's hamburger-munching corpse.
"You're supposed to wait until midterms before you go all pyro on shit," Nick chided him.
"I'm not going pyro, I just..."
"Look, you said you wanted to know what I can do, right?" Vince asked him.
"Why, yes, yes I do," Nick said with a series of enthusiastic nods.
"Then get a book of matches and meet me in the dorm," Vince repeated, pulling up the remainder of his food and walking away from the table. He dumped his refuse in the bin and made his way to the exit. He was relatively certain it would take Nick at least a few minutes to find some matches, plus a few extra to finish his burger. Vince was counting on those precious extra moments, because if he was going to try and do something with his power, he needed to get prepared and focus. And, just to be on the safe side, pray.
5. Vince had been in his room for only a few minutes when he heard a knocking at the door.
"No way he's that fast," Vince muttered to himself as he hopped up from his bed and opened the door. As it turned out, yes, there was a way that Nick was that fast.
"Hey, I got Mefriv,"
Nick mumbled through a mouthful of burger. In all of the scenarios that had run through Vince's head of how Nick would finish his meal and get matches, the possibility of Nick's curiosity overwhelming his desire to eat while stationary was one that had not occurred.
"How did you find matches so quickly?" Vince asked as he gestured for Nick to sit in the computer chair again. Mercifully, this time, Nick swallowed the food in his mouth before answering.
"They were lying on the ground by the door when I left the dining hall," Nick explained. "Let me guess, you used your power?" Vince asked rhetorically.
"Sure did," Nick replied with a grin. "I wanted to get this show on the road."
"Fantastic," Vince said dejectedly. "Just what I needed."
"Okay, see, now I'm confused. You're the one who volunteered to show me what you can do."
"What's the problem?" Nick asked.
I guess it's nothing, really. I just get nervous about using my ability," Vince admitted.
"Still? Didn't you go through the 2 months of therapy to get used to controlling it?"
Nick took another bite of burger after his question, clearly banking on Vince to do some explaining.
"Yes, and I can control it. Mostly. It's just there are some aspects to it I'm still working on.
Look, it should be fine. If we use matches, then everything will be okay," Vince said, reassuringly, though he never could have admitted who he actually was trying to reassure.
"Sweet," Nick said as he polished off his lunch. "So what do I do?"
"Just face me and light a match, then hold it up in front of you," Vince said. He sat down on the edge of the bed so that he was only a few feet from Nick.
"Can do," Nick said, pulling a book of matches from his pocket and carefully extracting one from the end.
Vince noticed the matchbook had a few missing from it already. It was a pretty decent guess that Nick had focused his luck and some poor smoker had dropped their matches without noticing. Much as he was hesitant to view luck as an ability, Vince had to admit it definitely had its uses. Meanwhile, Nick had plucked his match and was trying to light it with all the skill of a drunken hobo.